Welcome to Once Upon an Island, Tales from Lopez. I'm Ali Smulders, and with me is Janet Balzer, in for Laurie Harrison, who is in France this summer. I wonder whether you have listened last month to Larry Cochran, and if you did, you know that he had lots more to tell than he told us that first hour, and so he will be with us again today. And those of you who have not listened, remember that eventually all these programs will be archived, but they're also available at the library, and you can check out the CD from the library. We are very happy to have Larry here again today. And Janet, you want to ask a question?
Welcome, Larry.
Welcome. It's nice to have me back again.
Yeah. I'm not sure that I have a specific question, but we were just speaking of maybe going back to a certain time period when your family first moved here.
Well, I thought maybe we might sort of, as best I can, maybe do a little chronological review of the changes that have gone through the island. A lot of people, when they come here, they see it a certain way, and although I haven't lived through all these changes, but my family has been here since the early 1800s, or the early 1880s, and so I have seen a lot of the changes, or they have, and we have some documentation, and my grandfather was born here, and my dad and I, we were all born here on the island, and so we do know. At least I have what my grandfather remembers, and my stepfather was also born here, so I have a lot of his memories and stuff. So I do have, it's an oral history. It's as truthful as they can remember it and I can interpret it. So I guess we could start from there.
That sounds great.
So the Cochran family came here in 1883, and they homesteaded just south of Spencer's Spit. And he taught school and in the original Port Stanley Schoolhouse, which was actually on my stepfather's land, on the Caulfield land, which was probably a mile and a half or 2 miles from where they lived. As you go across, straight across the country, that would be just north of Hummel Lake.
So Port Stanley School was one of the earliest schools on Island.
Yeah, it was a log cabin. It sat on the corner, right when you go north from Hummel Lake and turn that very first corner. It sat right in there. There's a little gravel pit in there now. And George Barr lives on that property right at the moment. And that's where the Port Stanley School originated. If you go over to Port Stanley School, you'll see a plaque, and it says Edmund Cochran was the teacher, but they didn't spell his name right. It's Edmund Cochran, so, but you know, a lot of people had accents and dialects and stuff, so they may have mispronounced it a little bit. But anyway, they came there and they taught school and they played for dances and stuff. And the island at that time, there's a map on, or used to be at least on the University of Washington website somewhere, and it was a hand-drawn map around 1900, and it shows the Cochran homestead there, but they were just pockets all throughout the island, where they showed where there was clearings. There were no roads yet, really roads. They were like well-used, what we would call a well-used path, mm-hmm. and those became roads eventually and stuff. At that time, I don't even know if they had developed the fisheries yet to the extent that it became later in the years, but there was a lot of fishing. My grandfather said that one of the first jobs he had was greasing the skids for the bull teams to haul the logs out of the woods, you know, the oxen. He was 5 years old. Kids worked at that time. When he got right before he left here, they weeded onions for 10 cents a row. You know, it'd take him, he'd get two or three rows done in a day. You know, those were kids' jobs. A lot of logging. A lot of the old time Teamsters and stuff, Bat Clancy and these guys became, Seth Ritchie became famous for horsemanship, and at least within the island, their teams and their horses were really well known. All the old timers that, when I was a kid, talked about these guys and what great teams they had and what good horsemen they were. Going on a little farther, they left the island and moved away, but my aunt stayed here. My grandfather came back here when he was about 35 years old, and he married my aunt, or my aunt. He married my grandmother, who was a Greenwood, and they moved. They lived out on what's now called Salmon Point.
No, this was your grandfather, not my your great-grandfather.
My grandfather, yeah. And they lived on what's called Salmon Point now. At that time, it was called John's Point. And I think Washington Fish and Oyster or Columbia River Fisheries owned that whole peninsula out there at that time. And that my grandfather had been a steam donkey operator on the Hy-Le logging down in southern Washington and northern Oregon. And so when he came up here, he ran the big steam-powered pile drivers and stuff like that, and worked in. They were building the fish. They had the big fish traps in those days. It was. There were, when I still remember when I was a little kid, mountains of logs and rusting chicken wire all over McKay Harbor, piles of staples rusting into the water, rusted out derelict dories and stuff like that they use on the traps. There was still some docks and stuff. There was a little dock that came right out there from where the dock is on Salmon Point there, a little bit further out. And right above where that dock is now, there was a bunkhouse that my grandfather helped build and actually stayed in, because it was too far to go from down here on the island, or even when he was out there. He actually built a little house further out on the point and lived there. My dad was born out there. Bob Gallinger, who was my, I guess he would be my cousin, he was, his mother was my grandfather's older sister, and he tells me stories of, or told me stories of the time when you could stand up on the, above the lake on the hill up there, and there were no trees across toward Friday Harbor. That whole ridge had been gone, you know. So when people go and say, well, let's put it like it used to be, well, what are you referring to? Before we ever got here, or?
But your great-grandfather came here, I think the whole island was still full of trees, and then around 1900 it became logged.
They began to log it, and most of the logging, as far as I can tell, they didn't use it to build houses with it, but they considered the timber here to be very inferior. They brought, imported they built log cabins and stuff out of it, but when it came to building a really nice house, they brought the timber from over on the peninsula because of the rainforest, grew fast, straight, no knots and all this. This stuff, they built barns and a lot of cedar. I can still remember as a little kid, and this would be by 1950, there were still a lot of rail fences around the island, cedar posts and rails.
It's interesting that they would use, you know, more superior timber, because nowadays people talk about island fir, and that's supposed to be pretty good.
Well,
you know? But maybe it's all a matter of comparison.
Yeah, they just wanted the, you know, the straight grain and you know, the no knots and that sort of thing. So if you look at most of those houses are gone now. There's only two or three of them left around the island that were built, you know, that are much over 100 years old. So it's been a change in that respect. By probably the 20s, there was farming was really the big deal. There was still, I would say, most of the logging was done. I started to say that most of the timber went, when they first had ships coming in here, they were steam. And there was no coal out here, so it was all wood burning. And right down here, there was right here in Swift's Bay, there was a dock that went way out there. I don't even know how long it was. It was several hundred.
You can still see the rocks at low tide.
Yes, it was several hundred feet out there because it's a big mud flat there.
And is this where most of the traffic came?
This was one of the places.
The northern end.
There was also one right outside of Fisherman Bay. There was another long dock that went out way out there. And then there was one in at Islanddale, and then of course Richardson had a dock there too. But it was all this little fleet. Most of them came out of Bellingham. Anacortes was not developed yet at that time. They didn't have the bridge over the slough there and stuff, so it was easier to go up to Bellingham and then come on out, where they came up from Seattle. they exported it, you know, if they had a calf to sell, they went down and drug it out on the dock and hauled it onto the boat and off it went, you know, wherever it was going. Or they butchered it and took the meat out. There wasn't that big of a difference. They didn't have the regulations that they have now, you know. You could butcher a cow and load it in the pieces in the back of your wagon, your truck, and go peddle it off to your neighbors if you wanted to. And nobody, no, it was just the way it
no
was.
Inspection.
No inspection. I just realized something I kind of forgot. I can even go back a little bit further because I was friends with Dan Humes. He actually taught me how to shear sheep. And his father was a Chadwick from Chadwick on the south end of the island. And he actually, his grandfather, his father was a Humes, his grandfather was a Chadwick, and he actually worked for the Hudson's Bay Company and was a sheep herder on the south end of the island. And they brought sheep in and put them off on the island and had a sheep ranch there on the south end of the island. And that's one of the first things that was going on the island. He was British by choice, that's where he came from. He was married to an Indian lady from the Nea Bay area. And they had a family there, and the Humes brothers were quite well known around the island. And Addie Chadwick was very well known, very respected lady in the older community. There were a lot of the early men here that had Indian wives, just quite a number of them, you know. And as far as I know, there was no segregation, or you know, I mean, it was. Everybody was accepted, as far as I can tell. It was just common. We didn't. You know, I didn't even think about those things, especially when I was a kid growing up. I never thought about, people being different or anything like that. It just wasn't something that was reinforced in our life at all. Never even came up.
Yeah.
Which is probably a good thing.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
Because we didn't learn that, any of that kind of stuff as kids, so we're back up to in the 20s, and by that time there was an awful lot of farming going on, and agriculture had become a really big thing. For one, there were a lot of orchards planted, and you could get more land if you planted trees. You could get a tree grant, so a lot of these old orchards came about because of that. And the other thing that people did is the only way you had to preserve things was either pickling or smoking or something like that. You didn't have ice was not very plentiful around here. Everything that people had to eat, they either had to buy it or grow it, and buying it was expensive. And so, I can remember people rarely, they didn't even eat a lot of beef, you know. They ate deer, they ate fish, they ate chicken, but the calf that you raised got sold. That was the cash crop coming in. So people saved everything, even up into the 50s. I think the Depression probably stayed here until at least into the 50s, because it was still tough going. A lot of, even by the 1950s, the kids that I was around, whose parents I would say were the more well-off, in fact, one of the most well-off families on the island, those kids worked harder than anybody. Their dad had them out there working at 5 o'clock in the morning every day, loading cattle and moving stock and doing stuff, and they were really hard-working kids. Everybody worked, and that's always been an ethic here, I think, on the island, is people just, it was understood. Because of the nature of what we were doing, going back into that, everybody had to pull their weight. You know, the families tended to be a little bit on the bigger side. Dad was usually working off the farm. As the fishing industry developed more and more, and the logging went a little bit more by the wayside because of the trees, the old timber was gone, and so the men were out on the boats, and they began to go to Alaska, and and they had canneries down at Richardson and stuff like that. You know, even when I was a kid, it was you didn't drive back and forth on the island too much.
I like that story you told us before, and maybe you could tell us a little bit more about that. I mean, because you're talking in the 50s that you didn't. Yeah. How often did you get to go to the south end of the island again?
Well, remember, you went to Richardson, if I was lucky, maybe once a month.
Once a month, yeah.
And I really went past that. Mm-hmm. I mean, especially when I was small in the early 50s.
What were the roads like? I mean,
they were all gravel. The only paved road was on Fisherman Bay when I was a small kid. Just the bay, what they called the Bay Road in those days. And it went from about the library down to, I don't remember, it went up Woodman Hall Hill or not. But that was the only paved one on the island. All the rest of them were dirt. And they had a road grader out there, and that was one guy, that's all he did full time, was grade roads. They did a lot of the maintenance. They had small pick dump trucks, and one of the early things that they did, when my grandfather first bought the property where I live now, is you paid, this was during the pretty depressed times here, you paid part of your taxes by maintaining the road in front of your house. And that's how my uncle was killed when my grandfather's they had these wagons and they had planks in there that you could turn the plank sideways and it would spread on the bottom, and it would, you flip this lever and the planks opened up and it let the gravel drop out, and you'd do that, you know, and it would let the gravel spread on the road. And he was doing that, and his team was, my grandfather was loved horses, and he loved high stepping horses, spirited horses, so the team, apparently a truck came down the road further up the road and it backfired, and the horses got spooked and kind of bolted, and my Uncle Eddie was just a little guy, I think about 3 years old, and he went off the wagon, and my grandfather ran over him, and by the time he got the horses stopped, they'd run over him again, I guess. This is the story I heard. And he lived a couple of days, but there was so far out, you know, it was just too... Bellingham was the closest way, and how do you get the mail? Mail came a couple times, two or three times a week on a boat, and that was the only way to get anybody back and forth, and it just didn't, you know, it just wasn't something that they could do anything much about. So the island didn't change much, and I think the big population was probably in the 20s when the fish canneries were going and stuff. There was a lot of people here.
Were there any canneries going when you were a kid?
No, that closed. Was all gone. Mm-hmm. There was a creamery also Richardson where they, I don't know exactly whether they made butter, but I think people hauled in their milk and stuff like that. Even up when I was a kid, most everybody still had a couple of cows and agriculture, big gardens. I would say it's primarily subsistence farming. There were a few... There were still a few bigger farms. Most of the people were in dairy to some regard, but I would say they didn't ship milk. They didn't sell milk. They sold cream. The skim milk was fed to calves and hogs. A lot of hogs raised here. And then in the 40s and 50s, they started raising chickens. And there were, I don't know, three or four. My grandparents had, at one point, you know, several thousand chickens there, and the big barn up here where just to the west of me there, where the Adams lived, Roy Prescott built that, and that was full of chickens, and also down on right up from the village there, from the service station, there were a couple of big chicken houses there on I don't know. The very first place there was two big chicken houses.
Anyway, so that was around 1950 or so?
Well, this was in the 40s primarily.
In the 40s.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
The 40s up to about 55. Mm-hmm. Probably, I don't know, a 10 or 15 year period there when chicken farming, there was even a big chicken farm over on Shaw. I mean, there were big. The fruit industry got started really big, and then at Eastern Washington, they got the water in there and it just... killed it here. Although a lot of those, I started to say that earlier, a lot of these trees, these apple trees and stuff they planted, they did ship fruit away, but if you check those apples, a lot of those apples are nasty little things, and they had them to make vinegar out.
Vinegar.
Oh. Yeah, that was the only thing they had to preserve. They pickled everything, and they used it for to sanitize things. They even on the mobile slaughter unit that we have right now, because it's organic, a lot of the people do organic animals. They can't use any commercial or chemical kinds to depress bacteria, anything like that. So they use vinegar and they spray and it accomplishes two things. It sanitizes to some extent, but it also acts as an enzyme and helps break that meat down and make it a little bit more tender too. So that was another factor in vinegar production was probably a big, every house probably had a big barrel of vinegar.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
You know, well, you pickled fish and you pickled fruit and you pickled vegetables and you pickled meat and, they didn't have freezers. They didn't have, most of them didn't even have ice boxes. Mm-hmm. When I was still a little kid, my grandparents had a cooler. And what it was in the side of the kitchen, there was a like a little closet, and it had shelves in it that were open or had screen on them. And in there you kept your milk and your meat and your butter, and it had a shaft open to the outside, and then it went up in a column and was open at the top, so the air would circulate and go out through that. And now things didn't keep real long, but you know, milk is actually tastes better if you don't keep it quite as cold as we keep it now.
A lot of things taste better.
It has a sweeter taste to it, particularly if it's whole milk.
I still have a handful of friends who have those little boxes in their houses, and
yeah,
it's slowly disappearing.
Yeah, yeah, we still have one in our house. It's not functional anymore, but it's still there. But
I grew up with cellars. You know, you had a cellar, and that's where you kept things cool.
Mm-hmm. The other way,
but I never had, as long as I lived in the Netherlands, I never had an icebox of any kind.
The other thing that they had, like in the milk house, to keep the cream from souring, they had what they called the well, and it was about 3 feet deep, and it would hold, I think, about 4 10-gallon cream cans, and it was set down in the concrete, and they filled it with cold water, and it kept it full of cold water, and they set the cans down in there and kept them immersed in cold water, and that kept the cream. The creameries, and I'm talking now in the 40s and 50s, they would come around 2 or 3 times a week and pick up your cream, depending on, you know, your one can or your, some places only maybe had a half a 5-gallon can, but others would have, you know, 4 or 5 cans, if they had a bigger farm. So depending on how hard you could work. Most people didn't have more than about 35 cows, and that would be challenging for people to milk that many, because if you had to milk them by hand, and even though they still had electricity, even in the 60s, we would go for sometimes. I remember when I was in college, I brought some friends home to do a program, and we got to the island, and there was no power, and so we couldn't play our electronic instruments and stuff. So and there was no power then for like 10 days. The cable had broken or something. So, and that happened pretty frequently. Mm-hmm. When they first brought the power in, they only got to have it on for short periods of time during the day. You know, those peak times when the guys were milking the cows and early in the morning, when they would get up but nobody had electric heat. Nobody had you had a single light bulb in the ceiling, maybe, and if you were lucky, you might have a couple of outlets in your house.
And when was this? What was this time period?
This is still up into the 50s, 40s. When I was little, many of the older people who probably could have benefited the most from this didn't have it. They still had outside, you know, they still had an outhouse. They took a bath on Saturday night in a galvanized wash tub on the kitchen floor, heated the water on a wood stove, where they had these little reservoirs on the side of the stove that would heat water with coils inside that you could, which people are coming back to now. Mm-hmm. You still see them. They had no electricity at all. Many of the houses didn't, and they would cook for big thrashing crews. You know, two or three women would get together and put on a meal for, you know, 10, 15, maybe yeah. more people. You know, cooked on a wood range in the middle of a hot summer day. You know, or you know, yeah. Not many women would stand for that nowadays. But and a lot of the time, you know. The women actually ran the farm a big part of the year because the husband would be off maybe in Alaska fishing or out here with a fishing fleet or working on these big fish traps and stuff like that, you know, trying to make some cash money to be able to pay the taxes and you know, buy school clothes and stuff like that. It was so that it fell on the wives and the kids to keep the farm going and the garden in and the cows milked and the fences built and cut the wood. And
oh, even the fences built.
Oh, yeah, whatever you did. Whatever you did, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. There was some incredibly strong women around here still when I was a kid. There still are now, but, I mean, women who, you know, and they weren't, you know, they didn't wear jeans, and you know, women didn't wear. They wore dresses when I was a kid, you know, a little kid. And but they would still be out there milking cows and cleaning the barn and you know, gathering the eggs and whatever they had to do. I mean, they just, somebody had to do it, and a lot of times it was them. Interesting. In the '60s, we got discovered.
Lopez, you mean?
Lopez got discovered. I remember, I think it was 62, I had gone away to Cedar Woolley for part of the school year and part of the summer, and I worked on a farm. And we came back to the island, and they had widened the road from where I live right now to Hummel Lake intersection, and then it stopped and picked up again down past Fowler's and went on down through and changed down toward clear down to Islanddale. They changed all the road, and for some reason, I don't know if that just happened to be that way or whatever, but at that same time, real estate development began to start to happen here, and it just caught on like wildfire. And prior to that time, when my folks bought their place over by Hummel Lake, they bought it for, I think they bought 80 acres for $10,000 in 1952. And land basically was selling for just around $100 an acre. And by, I think, about the end of the, you know, in 20 years, it was selling for $1,000 an acre. And we all went, oh my gosh, what are we going to do? You know, we can't afford to farm this kind of land anymore. And many of the old timers in the '60s, most of the farmers were old. Most of the guys that had come back after World War II had tried to farm, and it was it just wasn't economically viable. So great many of them quit and went to work in Boeing and other places like that. Left the island, took their young families and left. And It took a long time for that to come back, people to come back here on a full-time basis and be able to work here and make a living.
Still a piecemeal. I mean, you hear about so many people who have different skills.
I have
skills
two or three jobs, and most of the people I know have, have a job and at least maybe a part-time job on the side besides that. It's still very difficult to keep going here.
I remember in 1956, so you were 11 years old, Oscar and I went to Orcas. You know, we lived in Southern California, and we decided we wanted to see the coast. And so we ended up camping at Moran State Park. And we thought, oh, this is beautiful. But the prices for the land were way too high. We had absolutely no savings. We were two students, you know, practically. And then Oscar asked, you know, what do you need here? And they said, we need a shoemaker. No, said Oscar, that's not my kind of thing. So, you know, and then we came back in 1970. So that was 14 years later. and we realized that orcas had changed very little. And we lived in Southern California, and if you were gone for 6 weeks, it had changed, you know. Mm-hmm. And so then the next year, and by that time we had three children, we came back to orcas to see whether we could buy a little piece of land. And when we didn't like it, they said, I think you would be happier on Lopez. And that's how we came to Lopez.
Orcas always had more of a, has had more of a tourism oriented more that
and
way.
And we didn't care for that.
And they've also had a little bit more
business-like.
Business and, more, a little bit more similar to what the mainland was.
Right.
This island has always been really strong in family, really strong in ties across. Like I said, I'm sure that there were different religions and different cultures and all that stuff on the island when I was a little kid, but I wasn't aware of it.
People just worked together.
They just worked together. They did. There was always been this thing: you need something, the neighbors come and help. Your neighbor needs something, you go and help. And that's still a really rich cultural thing here right now. I mean, you see all the benefits that we have and all the stuff, and people, and it's quite often the people that don't have the deep pockets that are out there giving the most. You know, if people don't have money, they people here like to give time, like to give energy, like to give knowledge. They like to participate in what they're involved in, and I think that's always been something that goes on clear back. As long as I can remember, there are pictures at the Historical Society of a big picnic up. I think it was on Lopez Hill or Chadwick Hill. I'm not sure the place, but where like the whole island at that time. My great grandfather, this would probably be prior to 1900, going to this thing, you know. I can remember like one of the biggest holidays around as far as the island was the 4th of July. All the kids that went off. When I was a kid, all those guys that had gone off after World War II all came back home and spent the time, with their families. And we had the Odlin Park would just be packed. There would be a big, baseball, it's always been a big thing here. Clear back into the 1800s. By 1900, they had, in the 20s, they had island teams. Phil Hastings was a tremendous young man and played shortstop then, and later on became a little league coach here. And Oliver Lundy, who had Richardson Store, had pitched for University of Washington. Nelson, they called him Lefty, Hid Nelson. He was a great baseball player. Dick Pickering Sr., I watched him pitch. Tremendous fastball. Otto Kiergaard was, a young guy at that time, and he was the catcher. And it was pretty intense. They would play teams from Bellingham, and of course Orcas and San Juan and LeConnor and wherever they could get games. And then if they couldn't get that, they'd play the old men against the young men.
Did you play when you were?
I was a little too young at that time, and I was never a very good baseball player. I played a little bit in high school, but I was bad. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I'm not. My athleticism, I was a runner.
Oh, yeah.
I was mostly a distance runner. And I ran 2 mile and 440.
That's a
we
race.
Actually had my team with three other guys here in 62. We set a record for Northwest B League that stood for the mile relay that stood for quite a long time.
Mm, wow.
I was not the fastest guy on that,
but it was neat to be part of it.
But you're telling about Phil Hastings being such a player. Betty told us she was 14 when she fell in love with him and thought, that's the man I'm going to marry.
Oh.
Yeah, they had a connection from a long time back, and they were very. They were very close, you know. I mean, it was neat to watch them together.
Mm.
Agriculture kept being a big part here, you know. And I'm going to make a reference back now to the sheep industry, where it came in with Hudson's Bay Company, and it's still going on right now on this island. It's been continuously going. Phil actually had descendants of some of those sheep that came from Hudson's Bay on his ranch when I was younger.
Can I just say one thing about Phil? It's only take a moment, but
sure.
Scott and I got married. Scott Steckman and I got married, and we purchased 2 pigs from Phil, and we gave him money, and there was extra. He owed us money, and instead of giving us, we said, "Oh, that's okay." It was like $10. He said, "Well, I'll give you chicken change," and so we said, "Oh, yeah, that's fine, wherever." So he left us change in our freezer, and it was 2 chickens. That was the change left from the 2 pigs. That I just had to tell a little story.
Yeah. You could, you know, people growing up here, I don't know where you'd find the people more honest and more forthright. You know, if they made a commitment, it was a handshake, and, you know, they were very careful to make sure that they fulfill their obligation. Mm-hmm. Because you live so close, and like I said, I was related to so many people here. You know, you don't want to be dividing up the relatives and choosing up sides and stuff. That gets nasty. So people were very careful about what they did. And even people who didn't necessarily like each other chose to get along. You know, they may have, you know, stepped around each other or whatever, but rarely that, you know, we had dances here all the time when I was a kid, and about once a month at the Woodman Hall, and it would be rare that it would be a fight, you know. But there was a lot of drinking and stuff like that, you know, outside, nothing inside.
Now, were there people here who, because of religious reasons, didn't want their youngsters to dance?
Oh, yeah.
Because that was true in Holland, that some people would consider dancing. That was not something you did.
And I think a lot of the, especially the older unmarried guys would go to the dance. And a lot of them, I remember, there was a big line around the edge of the floor. The people just standing there.
Just looking.
But, you know, and they did. I don't know that all of them did dance or didn't dance. I was too young to remember that. We kids could go. You would fall asleep over in the corner. They'd throw a coat over you, you know, or whatever. I learned to dance by standing on my mom's feet
you did.
And moving around, and then they had this thing called the brownie, and you would get your partner, and this is where the older women would go out and grab us kids, you know, and drag, you know, your aunts or your mother's friends or whatever would come and grab you and drag you out there, and you would go, and if they'd start off circling around the floor, and then you do an Allaman left, and you go around, and then they blow the whistle, and you do an Allaman left, and then they blow the whistle again, and that was your partner. Mm-hmm. So you might be dancing with a very beautiful young lady, or you might be dancing with somebody's grandmother, or a girl you couldn't stand, or somebody you had a real crush on, or your sister, or, you know, you just didn't know.
Everybody got the turn.
Yeah, and they were fun. Everybody got involved in that, and they were kind of like part, you know, it kind of broke the ice and got people, and, you know, to get out and get more involved and stuff like that. So then they would always stop in the middle at midnight and have sandwiches and coffee and stuff like that, and then go back and play for a while. And lots of times they'd take up a collection for the musicians and play for another half hour or something. And then they would a lot of times go to somebody's different homes and have breakfast, you know, and then go out and milk the cows.
Wow. So when did those dances stop? I mean, when you were a kid, like a high schooler?
They went on up through the 60s. Mm-hmm. And, they then began to gradually stop. And then they got down where they only had maybe like New Year's and maybe only 2 or 3 times a year, and they just gradually died.
Do you find now, living here on Lopez, do you miss that type of community, or do you have that kind of community within your own circles?
Well, I do, because I make it happen. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of people don't have it. A lot of what we did growing up, we created ourselves. You know, the musicians that played there were just the guy down the road. The guy who ran the automotive repair shop at the South End played the saxophone, and a farmer's wife played the piano, and different people played the drums. You know, I mean, it wasn't like they were necessarily, although they sound good, but I mean, that wasn't the criteria. It was just It was who was, and other people could sit in. I sat in with them when I got a little older occasionally, and different people. Just, yeah, it was fun. You know, it was just, it was spontaneous and it was creative, and you know, it was kind of a, like a pressure valve release, you know, because people had nothing. Even in the 60s, I remember when 1952, there was very, there was only a few TV sets on the island. And I remember going to the up to some friends to watch The Lone Ranger and Howdy Doody and Milton Berle on TV, you know, and wrestling. I hate wrestling. But
but you liked watching it then.
Yeah. No, I don't. It was something to do, it, you know. Yeah. I mean, it was a whole novel thing. It was black and white, and it was icky. But, you know, we never turned the TV on in the daytime or in the morning or anything. It never came on until 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon. I think your sister might have watched American Bandstand in the summertime, like, and that was on at 3 or 4 in the afternoon. But, you know, we just didn't even consider turning it on. And actually, about half the time when I grew up, we didn't have one anyway, because what we ended up were old used sets that would last a while and then they would die. And so we would be back. And so I learned to play the guitar and that sort of thing. And but things changed as you know, when that when we got discovered, then property values began to go up and people began to come here and be part-time residents. There were only a few of those on the island. People who were here maybe had summer homes or something like that. There weren't a lot of them around. A lot of people came back, but they came back to their families. You know, college kids, they would come back and spend some summer in the summer or on holidays, you know, with their families. So we would see a lot of our people that we didn't know really well in the summertime or on holidays. But then people became to come in here and they weren't full-time residents. And they built homes and didn't live in them for, you know, so that changed the dynamic of the island somewhat. Now, they did provide work, and they did pay taxes and stuff like that, but they were, I don't know how involved they were with the community. Some you could be as involved as you wanted to be, and some of them were, and some of them were not. Where on the other hand, the core residents here, you know, we were interacting every day in some way. You know, the whole island waving thing, you know. You know, if I didn't wave at my cousins going down the road, they would be upset with me. So you just automatically start waving at everybody. And so that just kind of grew from that. I don't know when I know by the time I was a kid, I was waving at everybody. But you knew everybody. People didn't go out and buy a new car every year or two. They had the same car. You knew it as soon as it came around the corner up there. You knew it was, you know, Mr. Jones or whoever it might be. You know, I don't even know if there were any Joneses here then. But
it used to be that you saw on the ferry a lot of old cars. And I was saying to Oscar, because we wait, because we like an elevator for me. So we wait and we see everybody come by. And I said, nowadays you see nothing but shiny new cars, and it used to be, you know, old jalopies.
Yeah,
that's what you saw. Those were people's island cars, and the few times that they went off island, they used the same car.
Even many people who lived here part time had an island car. At the ferry landing, there used to be in the 60s and 70s, there was dozens of cars parked there that were only used on weekends and sometimes only in the summer or only, you know, maybe once or twice a month. They've got to be so many there, they actually started towing them away at one point and getting rid of them because there were so many of them that just kind of got abandoned there. Mm. Wouldn't move anymore. They didn't get run enough. We came... I'm trying to think of where I left off here now. I got a little bit.
You were in the 60s.
Yeah. The real estate began to develop, and they the value of the property, and you know, when I was younger, if we built one or two homes on the island, that was about all that was built. Then it became an industry of its own. And so there was a couple of guys who were sort of like contractors, but really what they would do is do a little maintenance projects, you know, rebuild somebody's front porch or, you know, remodel their kitchen or something like that, and they just work independent by themselves. And they would maybe once or twice a year they would build maybe one home. And a lot of homes would be built in stages over a period of years. Because that was all that, they only had $5,000, and when that was spent, they were done, but then they had to go make some more money and come back. And they lived in them, in unfinished states.
Angel Lopez is never finished.
Well, a lot of them did it because they figured they weren't going to get taxable value until it was finished. But the county decided at one point that after a certain period of time, you're going to get taxable value whether you finish it or not. So that kind of stopped that. But even then, when I was a kid, people didn't have a lot of money, and they spent their available cash, and when that was done, they may take them 3 or 4 or 5 years to build a house. But then it became a business, and then Sunset Builders came in over by Hummel Lake,
It was by Hummel Lake?
Yeah.
Where the Grayling Gallery was.
Oh, that was Sunset Builders. Yep, Earl Yost. And I believe Chuck Deitch was involved in that right from the beginning. And they started a building supply place. And there were a couple other people prior to that time that actually you could get building supply from, but they didn't carry stock. The only place you could get anything like that close to that would be at Richardson's store. And they had a meat block up on the top a little butcher shop area, and right over next to that, the piles of Levi's and sweatshirts and stuff, and then go downstairs, down on the main floor they had groceries, and down in the basement they had hardware and cattle feed and chicken feed and all that, and then you go out on the dock and you could get kerosene and gasoline and diesel and whatever you need. So it was kind of like you could get everything you needed. The store. Where the store building was where the Fudge place is right now. That was the grocery store then. And the post office was in that point also there.
At Richardson is where Holly B. started.
Yeah.
She was 19 and she would sell bread there. And one time I asked her, because we were always here in August before we moved here full time. And Mark had a birthday in August. And I said, do you think you could make a chocolate cake? And she said, yes, I think I can. And so she said, would $3.50 be too much? And I said, it looks beautiful. I don't think $3.50 is too much. That was a beautiful chocolate cake that she made.
Wow. Yeah, a lot of the businesses that are around on the island right now started in a little, real humble.
Little bit.
Islands Marine Center, actually, Ron started that in the basement of Richardson store. His parents had Richardson store at that time, the Mangs did, and he started that outboard repair shop, and it grew into being one of the bigger businesses on the island.
Yeah.
And
it's fascinating to figure that out,
But there was like right here at Schiff's Bay, there was a shipyard there. The remains of it was, there were still boats on the waves. There was a set of ways there to pull boats out, for you could build a ship in or haul it out and work on the bottom and stuff. Their tracks were there. Yeah, they had a donkey engine set up there, and they had tracks that ran out into the water, and you could pull a boat out and work on it and stuff.
Now,
like
you said
that.
A donkey engine the second time. Does that mean that they're...
Okay, it's not a donkey.
Okay.
it's an engine set up, and it has drums on it with a big spool. And it has cable on it, wrapped on it, and you can pull things with it. And they used it to log with. They would have a donkey on each end of it. They had what they call a high lead. That's what my grandfather did. And in the woods, they were powered with steam because they had all this slash and stuff, and they used that to burn and run the steam engine. And then other places, they were ran on coal. And whatever was available, they ran the steam engine on. A lot of the farm steam engines ran on straw. When they were harvesting, they move them, they burn the straw from the straw pile. Mm. But they would have a donkey, an engine on each end of this high lead, an engine with one, and they would have an endless cable that would go back around. So they would have a pulley over here on one side, a pulley up here, and up in the center they'd have another pulley that was hanging from a track, a cable, and from that they would suspend a log say for instance. So if the log was on this side of the creek, they could go down and set a choker, which would be a cable around it, pick it, then they would put the donkey engine in gear and pull this drum this way, and it would roll a cable up on the spool and lift the log up, pull it across the ravine and deposit it where they want it, or onto a railroad car or a truck or whatever. And then they would throw it in the other direction. Sometimes they had drums that work opposite ways. So one was taking up the cable and the other drum was letting it off. Mm. And now they might have two donkeys. It was a long distance or a bad haul or something. They might have one on each end. But a lot of times it was just one doing it, you know. In the early days, they were powered by steam. And later on, they were powered by gas and diesel and you know, whatever they had. There wasn't any. Even when I was a kid, there were still a few places using horsepower here. You know, it was when I was little. My grandparents still had horses. I don't really remember them, but my mom had a picture of me sitting on one of them. But that's too far back for me to remember. There was a couple of saddle horses around when I was littler, but not the workhorses. Yeah. There were still teams around the island, but the only people I saw actually work them were old Mr. Henry Bartlett, who lived back on the south end of the airport. And my mother's parents had the north end of the airport. Their barn was right about where the clubhouse is right now, and that little false-fronted building that out by the road, that's where they lived. And Henry would drive his team. When he got his pension check on the first of the month, he would get his team out and hook it to the wagon and go to Lopez store early in the morning, and he'd come back through there in the afternoon and rest the horses and have dinner with my grandparents and bring us penny candy, and we got to play with the horses, pet them and sit on them and stuff.
Did people have horse and buggies too?
They did prior to, you know, that was pretty much gone by the time I was here. There were still some buggies and stuff around stored in the old barns, and I saw a lot of them, but they were pretty much, you know, I wasn't born until 45, so my stepdad, actually, he was born in early 20s. When he was 12 years old, he bought a Model T Ford. And he had it for a long time. He actually ended up, when he passed away, he had bought the car back and completely restored it, and he still had it. Hmm. And his nephew, George Barr, still has it there. Or maybe his brother Roger has it. I'm not sure which one of them has it. But, they didn't have a driver's license, or not on Lopez, you know, nobody.
My dad had an old Model T in the barn that he used to drive around, and I used to love to sit in the old Model T and pretend like I was driving down the road.
Yeah, well, they had a foot clutch in them. They didn't have a gear shift, and you know, you had to shift gears with your foot, and it was, you know, it's a different deal than what we're used to now. So it was a little bit different, but you know, the roads, even when I was a kid here, they would get pretty tough to get around in the winter time sometimes. You know, people didn't travel.
Big potholes, I'm sure.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah. You know, so much of your time, and I think I touched on this before, was people's lives centered around the farm. You know, you got up in the morning and you milked the cows and you fed the chickens and you did, then, you know, kids went off to school and the husband went off to whatever job he was working at the time, and the wife went, she never stopped. She'd been working probably since four, so.
Yeah.
And then when you got back home, you milked the cows and you had dinner and you did your homework, and you know, and on the weekends you either worked on the farm or you went to work for the neighbor, or you know, if there was that doesn't mean that we didn't have time to play. There were baseball games going on all the time, and school programs and church programs but those things were all, 4-H was really big, and my sister, I know, took piano lessons and dance lessons, and just, you know, there was stuff going on, but not to the, you know, you valued those little times that you had, you know, that you looked forward to them. The big thing that I don't even know when it started, but the actual, I think the first county fair was actually on Lopez Island.
Oh, really?
And it became, then they moved it to the docks on in Friday Harbor. Mm. It was down on, the first one or two were down on the docks, uh-huh. right down on the, by the canneries, down in the, mm-hmm. in the cannery buildings. And then they moved it, then they developed the fairgrounds out there mm. and stuff. But that was a big deal when I was little, was, you know, when I was about 9 out of 10, I started going to the fair, and that was a big thing. You know, yeah. that was like a highlight of our summer. You know, we groomed our animals and took them to the fair and stayed overnight. We mm-hmm. stayed there for 3 or 4 days and slept upstairs in the barn, sleeping bag, and you know, you were kind of on your own, you know, away from your parents, and it was a little scary, but it was a lot of fun, and it was a big highlight.
Yeah,
going to do
sounds
that.
Like a quite a big adventure.
Yeah, for a kid out here, it was, that's for sure. In the last little while, the big change I think that's happened is the fact that people used to have to come here and alter their lifestyle pretty dramatically if they moved to the island. Mm-hmm. You know, they didn't have access to mm-hmm. all the things that you have on the mainland. There wasn't even a restaurant here open all year round most of the time. Now there are numerous restaurants. There are, you know, particularly with the advent of cell phones and the computer, people can live here and work virtually out of an office anywhere in the world. I mean, they can be connected anywhere they want to be. So people don't have to alter their lifestyle. They can go, you know, they can make money that has nothing to do with what's going on right here in their life.
That's very true. But I think also, as gasoline becomes more expensive and there will be less of it, we may actually go back to a time when you're more connected with the place where you live. That's where you grow your food. That's how you manage.
Well, we are seeing a big visitation to agriculture right now. Mm-hmm. There are many people now who are going back to having their own cow, for instance.
Yeah.
A lot of people are having at least chickens so they can have their own eggs.
Gardening. I love the egg boxes on Lopez. Yeah. I want to take pictures of them all.
Gardening is a big thing now. People are getting much more interested in that. I have friends that do the farmer's market and stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a relatively new thing, and it's letting us be entrepreneurs on a small scale without having to, you know, ship things, the expensive thing of shipping everything to the mainland and then bringing it all back. We are being able to sell directly to customers here on the island, so it's made a big difference as far as the economics of farming and what people are able to do.
Well, I'm afraid we've come to the end of our program. Thank you so much, Larry.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. It's been a really fun to do this, and you know.
And thank you for listening.
Yeah.
This program was pre-recorded.